Disclaimer, the views and opinions you hear on this show are not the opinions of AnimeNewsNetwork.com.
From Los Angeles, this is AnCast. I'm Justin Savakis.
And I'm Zach Birchie. And for once, we actually have a show we can talk about because we both watched something. Your review of it went up today, I guess. Today's Tuesday. Tuesday before New York Anime Fest is when we're recording this. We both saw Senko Roll. And take it away. What did you think?
Well, I was both simultaneously really, really, really excited about it and completely let down.
Mm-hmm.
I was really excited about it because...
I just opened a soda. We should mention we're recording this in Justin's hardwood floor apartment in Hollywood, and for some reason the microphones are picking up absolutely everything we do. So sorry about that deal.
Yeah, what can I say? It's a room with a lot of echo.
So. Yeah, that's all right. Anyway, so go on.
All right. So anyway, it's really visually innovative and gives you that feeling, that like gut level feeling of I don't know what the hell is going on. There's no way I can predict what's coming next. But this is really cool and I can't look away. And I used to get that all the time when I was a new anime fan, and I haven't gotten it in years.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly missed that feeling. And it was so atmospheric and interesting for me on that level that I could almost forgive it for basically being a really, really amazing episode one and not really standing by itself very much. There's so much going on under the surface, and there's so much we don't know about the world it inhabits that I kind of was like, this could have been so much more and could be so much more. I literally told Aniplex, I'm like, please make a series.
Well, obviously you can't comment on whether or not they're going to do that.
Well, they just nodded.
Right. I'm not sure I had that strong a response to it in terms of like, wow, this is amazing and I don't know what's going to happen next. I did like it. I really thought it was a neat, more of a proof of concept even than a first episode, because a first episode, I don't think would have crammed that much in, that much action in, that much plot in,
right,
without more exposition.
Right.
Because, I mean, the basic plot is there's a bored guy, he has a weird white monster blob marshmallow thing that can transform into anything,
mm-hmm,
and a precocious girl who's fascinated by it meets him, and then there's another kid who's, I guess, evil and has two of them. He has two of them?
Yeah.
And they fight. That's pretty much what happens.
Yeah, it doesn't go much further than that.
It doesn't go much further than that. A lot happens, but it's all related to all of that. And, I mean, the thing that I thought was really interesting and kind of brilliant about it was the notion that these kids are really bored with these things. I mean, at least the main character, he's so over it. I mean, he spends half the movie, he's just like, whatever. And I really liked how they portrayed that and just how ridiculously uncreative he is. Because the things he asks Senko to turn into is a pair of scissors and a generic sedan and a bike. You know, he literally has this amazing monster that can turn into anything. And he may as well, like, turn it into a box of Tic Tacs. I mean, the kid is totally bored with it. Never had any creative mind to do anything with it anyway. And I thought that was a really, really interesting character. That's a really, really cool take on that sort of bored Japanese youth that just, even in this amazing fantasy world, is just so over it.
Yeah.
You know? And it got me thinking, like, maybe this will launch, like, a genre of, like, bored monster fighting kids. So it'll have, like, Pokemon and Ash will be like, all right, Pikachu, whatever, man. I choose you. Okay. Totally bored with it, just way over it. I thought that was really interesting. But yeah, 25 minutes, not enough. And it, like I said, it seemed way more like a proof of concept. Like, hey, here's something cool we could do. We could do more of this, but here's the general idea.
Mm.
That's why it didn't even strike me as like a solid like episode one.
Well, most episode ones you don't get a whole lot.
Right.
And this you got quite a bit of both story and atmosphere, and I thought, you know, on that level it was probably better than an episode one. It was like an episode one plus two.
Mm-hmm.
But and I like that it didn't waste time, you know, with a still frame while you hear his thoughts. Because, well, let's face it, cheap TV anime, that's totally how they would stretch out episode one.
Slow pan over a static background.
Exactly. So on that level, I was pretty pleased by it. I didn't think it was quite as lacking in the character development as I think you did.
Yeah, I did at points find myself kind of going, okay, and, like, what else is there to this? But overall, I mean, I don't want to downplay it. It was really, really fascinating, really interesting, something new. I really hope they make more of it, like you said.
Yeah. So that's Senko Roll, and hopefully if you're going to New York Anime Fest this weekend, you'll have a chance to watch it yourself.
Yeah, that'll probably be packed.
Yeah, there'll be other chances as well. I mean, that I don't know specifically what the plans for this show are, but I don't think this will be the last you see of it.
Well, when you're done jerking it to AKB48, you can hose yourself off and check out some Senko Roll.
Oh, Zach. Okay. I am so excited to be going to New York Anime Fest now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you are looking forward to it, right?
I am, but not for the fest so much as just I miss New York. I moved away 3 months ago, and it's kind of killing me.
Right. Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so the other thing we wanted to hit in this first segment, you went to Meltdown Comics, which is the famous Los Angeles comic book store.
Yeah.
I don't know if famous, but it's popular.
I've never heard of it before this.
Well, that's because you're not cool, Justin. You're totally male. So you went to this sale. They were having a huge sale.
Yeah.
Tell us about the sale.
Well, basically, they were blowing out around 2,000 manga books. What essentially happened is they're right in West Hollywood. And as a result, a lot of studios order a ton of stuff from them, and they just... For research purposes, you know, as much as we like to fool ourselves into thinking that manga is our little secret and no one knows about it, everyone knows about it, and there are whole staff at every major studio just trolling through this stuff looking for something licensed. So basically what happened is they ordered a ton of this stuff and got a lot of canceled orders as these low-level staffers figured out, hey, look, there's scanlations online.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a combination of that, just stuff they overordered, and just stuff that sat there and has been sitting there for years. So they just decided to blow it all out. And for, hey, a buck a pop, I had to go through some of them.
What'd you wind up getting?
Well, I did not think I was ever going to find this, the second book of the Pat Labor manga, which Viz canceled because it sold nothing. What was interesting was when I was going through it was you found the stuff in big quantities that you know had probably been bought for a studio, and their selection of what they bought was bizarre. Like, there was a nice big stack of the Kodansha translated pocketbook edition of Bo-chan.
What the hell is Bo-chan?
Bo-chan is an old-fashioned comedy about a renegade school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically what GTO was kind of inspired by. But it's old, you know, old Japanese literature. What else did I get? They had a ton of CMX stuff. And we know the CMX stuff they weren't looking for. The CMX stuff just didn't sell.
Yeah.
All that old, you know, shoujo stuff that they licensed that no one's ever heard of. So there was some of that. A bunch of old Viz flopped manga. It's just interesting to see what hasn't sold over the years.
Now, you said there was a lot of Tokyo Pop stuff.
Yeah, quite a bit. And usually the stuff that I knew no one wanted, like a lot of their manhwa, just, you know, random issues, like, you know, volume 16 of Katakano after a bunch of people had kind of forgotten about it.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Now, I mean, I found out about this through a really good interview that Deb Aoki did over on her blog. She did a really good interview with I think it was the owner of the store.
Mm-hmm.
He mentioned that the only things that really sell in terms of manga are the prestige Viz releases like Children of the Sea, stuff like that.
Right.
Things you would expect sort of hip LA people to be into. And then Naruto.
That interview made me laugh a lot because he had a lot of really, truly terrible advice for the manga companies.
Like what?
He's like, you guys should release more of the old Tezuka stuff. And, you know, he's like, my best sellers are the stuff from Vertical. Well, I know what sells in everywhere else, and it is kind of the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, well, of course at a store like that, the high-minded, the really sort of educated stuff is gonna move.
Right, but that's like 4 or 5 stores in the country that will benefit from that.
Right, and they're all exactly like Meltdown.
Exactly.
It's a nice store. I've been in there. It's a nice store.
It's a nice place. Everything's, unless they're blowing stuff out, everything's full retail, so.
Yeah, and you know, the funny thing is that every time I see, because you rarely see manga on sale, or in bargain bins, or in the Borders, bargain bin next to the bulk Ziggy comics and stuff.
Yeah, that's because the bookstores can send them back.
Right.
Comic book stores, not so much.
But even at conventions, like, they'll have these big bins, and it's like 5 for 20. And to me, that still does not seem cheap enough. A dollar $1 a book, that seems like the right price for bargain manga.
Well, the thing is, I mean, first of all, they're books, so they're heavy to ship. So at $1, I mean, they were taking a loss on the shipping.
I'm sure.
But
the stuff has been in their inventory for years, right?
Well, yeah, and I had honestly, you don't, unless you're in front of bins of 2,000 books that nobody wants, you forget just how much absolute garbage has been released on this market. This is a flooded market.
Yeah.
It's no wonder that sales have, you know, started to peak or maybe fall a little bit.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're going to have your evergreen titles like your Naruto's and your One Pieces and your Bleach. I can't even think of, like, what the other evergreen titles are. But then again,
Fruits Basket.
Yeah, I'm not a huge manga guy.
I'm trying to get a little more into it, but it's so expensive.
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, I paid $10 for a book, and I'm done with it in a half hour.
That's true. And the two series I was reading, I mean, admittedly, I got a little... I'm fatigued, I'm berserk. You can only handle so much monster rape. Eventually, by volume 29, it's like, okay, raping monsters. Then Guts cuts the raping monster's head off, and then here's another raping monster. Like, okay, all right.
Berserk is so relentlessly dark. I really had trouble getting into it.
Well, I was reading that, and I was reading Helsing, and Helsing got really weird and kind of stupid at the end. So it's not dumb. Like, yeah, it is dumb. I mean, it kind of just... jumps the shark, as much as I hate to use that overused phrase. I don't know.
The only manga I was buying everything of was Please Save My Earth, and that ended like 2 or 3 years ago.
How many volumes was that?
21. There was a lot of old, like, you know, the huge oversized CPM manga books.
Yeah, I remember that.
I'm sorry, nobody wants Geobreeders.
Geobreeders? Oh my god. I remember having like 2 or 3 copies of that, just sitting in a corner in the corner of the office, just collecting dust.
Oh, and all the really terrible Kiyo Asamiya stuff.
Yeah. I never got why people shit themselves over Kiyosumi in the first place. I cannot handle his chins.
I'm ho hum on his character designs. I like the rest of his art,
yeah.
But he can't tell a story worth jack. Like by two pages in, I'm completely lost. So way back in the day, you might remember this. Rurouni Kenshin was listed to American TV broadcasters under the name Samurai X.
Yeah, I remember.
Did you ever see the horrible old Animax Asia dub that they used to solicit this?
I've always wanted to, and I've heard about it, and I remember anime fans back when, like, the fan sub tapes were coming out, and then we heard about that dub, and we heard, like, the names were changed, and it was really crappy, and everybody was losing their shit, because, oh no, they've ruined Kitchen, and I've always just been curious to see really what it was.
Well, they didn't change any names that I can tell.
So this is out, you can see this.
Well, yeah, there's this website that posted it. It's owned by Sony Pictures. It's kind of their crappy knockoff of Hulu called Crackle.com.
Dumping ground.
It's like old episodes of, you know, I Love Lucy and things like mm-hmm. that. Yeah, they posted all but one episode of the original Animax Asia dub of Samurai X.
How many did they do?
94.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it's the whole show.
The whole show?
Yeah.
God, I'm tempted to see what they did with all that awful German shit at the end. Oh man, it's gonna be bad.
Yeah. So anyway,
I didn't know this was up.
Yeah.
Why don't we pull it up?
Here you go.
We can do the audio. Hang on.
Okay. The way to a new era, the Meiji era. But as the disturbances ended, he disappeared. While his whereabouts remained a mystery, the name Batusai the Slasher.
Batusai the Slasher. God, this is awful. It sounds like from the Midwest.
I wonder where they dubbed this, because this doesn't sound like it was dubbed in Asia. Was this dubbed here, maybe?
In a dumpster behind a 7-Eleven in Kansas.
Wait. Batusai the Slasher.
Ooh. Ooh?
I have finally found you. You're a gentle-looking man, Batusai the Slasher. What in the...
Sounds like she's trying really hard to take that shit.
So are you really the legendary slasher?
Stop saying legendary slasher.
He did how many people at once?
Wanderer. All I am is a wandering swordsman with no place to go. Do you think I can slash anyone with this sword?
Is that the same voice as the American one?
No, it sounds pretty close, though.
What is this? The edge is reversed.
It's a reversed edge sword.
Why is the edge reversed?
I don't know. The reverse is edge. Edge is reversed.
And you don't see any evidence of slashing, right? Oh,
Clearly, I have not been slashing this day.
Perfect condition. It seems like it's practically brand new.
You know it wasn't me, don't you?
Ugh, okay, shut the shit off.
All
right, I've seen enough.
It's not good. There's a reason that everyone, you know, reacted so strongly to it back in the day.
It does kind of make me want to skip through some of the later episodes to see how bad it is. Now, I hated the English dub of Rurouni Kenshin, the Media Blasters one, anyway.
Yeah.
Because they insisted on keeping his Japanese vocal patterns or whatever, and he was like, I will pick up these turnips, I will. And it's like nobody fucking talks like that. It's so distracting. I don't care how accurate it is.
It's not a good dub at all. But this is worse.
This
is a lot worse.
That was very amateur hour. That was very fan dub. That's what that seemed like to me.
Or early ADV, if you prefer.
Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of dubs, we've got our guest just about to come on. You want to take a break?
Yep.
Okay.
Kenshi! What a great cook! Outrageous!
Really?
He's the one who told me to be good at swords.
He's the one that forced me to deal with this out-of-control little kid.
How come you're not eating those chewy ones that you made?
Because the rice balls that Kenshi made are a lot better, and you know it. You're just like me. With your feisty and competitive attitude, I feel like I have a bratty little brother who could really be good if he'd only listen to his big sister.
I can't help it. I know you're talented and very good at swords. But since I saw the way Kenshi fights...
All right, joining us over Skype from beautiful Boston, Massachusetts, is our good buddy Mike Toole.
Cambridge, Massachusetts,
Cambridge.
Technically.
All right.
But Boston.
Thanks for screwing that up, Justin.
It's what I do.
Okay, Mike. Well, dude, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
What I kind of wanted to start with is you used to run, everybody knows you used to run the site Anime Jump. Now, you're not doing that anymore, right?
It's never officially gone away, but yeah, it's on long-term hiatus.
Okay.
I don't have any immediate plans to bring it back.
So the place people can read your writing now, when you're not doing one video every 3 years for Anime News Network, is in Anime Magazine.
Excuse me, one video every 2 years.
Sorry.
Right.
Excuse me. So the place people can read you now is what's left of the Anime Magazine market, basically.
Yeah, Otaku USA.
And that's it? That's the only place you're writing for anymore?
Pretty much, yeah. I had a 3-year relationship with Sci-Fi Magazine, but they changed publishers, and there were issues that led to us ending the arrangement.
That sucks. You have a very successful career otherwise, so it's not like you're living off this stuff anyway, but I can totally sympathize with the mercenary freelancer attitude, because when you are a freelance writer, and most everyone who writes about anime is freelance, I think ANN staffers and people who are on staff at Otaku USA and like Anime Vice, kind of the only ones that do it full time. But you do this freelance, so I mean, has it gotten any better? Has it gotten worse over the years in terms of just like getting paid and getting good projects? And I mean, what's it like out there?
I'd say it's been about the same for a long period of time, and because of that, I would venture that it's kind of gotten a little worse. My biggest beef with writing freelance about Japanese animation is that I started doing it in 1996 for On America magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I was being paid 10 cents per word.
Wow.
And now I write for Otaku USA, and for the most part, for that stuff, I get paid 10 cents a word.
Ooh.
So the wages I get for writing about anime have not gone up in 13 years.
Do they actually pay by the word?
Yes.
Because in my whole career, we never did that. It was always a flat rate. It was always like, okay, 1,000 words, $350. Like, or not 1,000 words, like 2,000 words, $350 or something like that.
Yeah, well, articles are spec'd out based on an estimate of how many words they want. And if you're over that or under that a little, then it's calculated out based on a rate.
Wow. And so, like, what was the last big thing you wrote? What's the last thing people could see in?
If you look at the current issue of Otaku USA magazine, I've got a few reviews in there. I've got a feature on Slayers, and I think one or two other features. I just wrapped up a feature on Gunslinger Girl for the forthcoming issue.
Cool. Now, so I gotta ask, I don't really know Patrick Macias, who runs Otaku USA. I don't know him that well. My experience with Anime Magazine sort of starts and stops at Anime Insider and Protoculture Addicts, but when I read Otaku USA, it's pretty much just like whatever Patrick feels like putting in the magazine that month. Is that an accurate description, would you say?
I'd say it's fairly accurate, and not to cast aspersions on Patrick, because
no,
aside from Anime Insider, every anime magazine I've ever written for has essentially been run like a fanzine,
mm-hmm.
which is to say that the editor will just, you know, come booming out of nowhere with a bunch of vague ideas and just take whatever is thrown at them. I mean, that is how Onimerica was produced for the most part.
Yep.
Every once in a while, thanks to their in-house connections with Viz, they'd score a very nice interview or a very nice feature. But essentially, it was just, you know, they'd hit up all their freelance writers and say, okay, gang, what do you want to write about this time? And what, you know, Patrick's approach, he's actually an alumna of Onimerica Magazine, is not so different. He just, a little while before it starts to get close to the publication date, he'll come at us with a list of things he'd like to cover, but, you know, we'll take most suggestions. A couple of issues ago, there was a big feature article on Captain Harlock. He's run a big feature on Speed Racer. So, you know, the staff are given pretty free rein over what they want to do with what they're writing about, and that's one of my favorite things about the magazine. The writers are allowed to have pretty unique voices. There's not a style.
Yeah, that's pretty much the opposite of the way things were at Anime Insider. Not only were we discouraged, and I could talk about this because the magazine's kerplunk anyway, not only were we discouraged from writing about anything that was not the newest hotness that month, so every issue had to have Death Note, Bleach, whatever, in it. And, you know, I loved working there and everything like that, but not only, and this was pretty much wizard policy, like, had to be the latest, hottest thing and no voice. Everything had to sound like it was being written by the same sort of generic positive person.
And no opinion either, right?
And there was a strict no opinion policy. The way we defended that was we would say, well, we only write about stuff that we like. Which, of course, wasn't true.
I call bullshit.
That was not true at all. But that was the justification. Not to say anything bad about Anime Insider. I loved working there. I'm still very good friends with those people. But that magazine was sort of the height of sort of homogenous, not a fanzine at all, very much a corporate-sounding kind of magazine. So
I think it kind of had a voice. It's just that the voice was, you know, teenagers with attitude.
It was Bubsy.
Oh, no. Bubsy.
Despite the fact that this was not a magazine that I wrote for that often, and it certainly didn't serve an audience like me, I think it's a sin and a shame that the magazine is no longer being published, because it, you know, it wasn't doing great, but few magazines are, and it was my impression that it wasn't really losing the company money. It just,
no.
You know...
If you want the truth, I'll say it. Like, the reason that Anime Insider went down and Wizard didn't, Wizard Magazine didn't, and Anime Insider outsold Wizard pretty relatively commonly.
Really?
Nobody reads Wizard.
Yeah.
Wizard Magazine?
I don't know. I see it on shelves everywhere. I never see anyone reading it,
right.
But I never see anyone reading anything.
It's a vanity thing. They couldn't let their flagship publication go down.
Right.
So that's, in my to my knowledge, that's what happened there. But, you know, anyway, I could have been here to say, I don't know. But to my knowledge, that's what happened. Anime Insider was not an unsuccessful magazine. It was an unsuccessful company that owned it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what happened there. So moving on, the other thing that people know you from are your panels, your hugely popular Dubs at Time Forgot panels. And we run some of those on the site. And I know you and Justin have this in common with this sort of obsession
with old crappy dubs that no one remembers.
Yeah.
Hey, man, they're not always crappy.
But most of the time.
Usually.
Yeah.
And I was surprised to hear that whenever you do one of these panels, you try to do, if not 100%, mostly new material every time.
Well, part of it is I like to make it a unique experience at every event I go to. And part of it is there's just so much material. You know, I go back to the well several times a year, just tracking down old VHS tapes, old stuff from all over the place. And the supply just never really seems to go down.
It's so hard to believe.
I know. Well, I've actually been working with them a little bit on this, blew way too much money earlier this month on it, actually. But for example, we just found the massive well that is UK only dubs.
Mm-hmm.
And there were at least about 30 releases, 30 dubs in the UK that were just never released in the States or redubbed. Would you say that's about a good number, Mike?
30? Yeah, I'd say that's pretty accurate.
Could you tell us about some of the ones that we've gotten so far from UK?
From UK? Well, there have been a number of dub stuff that was released in the UK that has not been released in the US, but was released in the US with a different English version. For instance, Manga UK dubbed the Lupin the Third Secret of Mamo movie, which is one of my favorites because that movie has been dubbed in its entirety 4 times, which I think sets the record.
Yeah, let's see. Streamline did it. Pioneer did it. Manga UK did it. Who else did it?
The Japan Airlines actually produced the original dub.
It was either
Japan Airlines or it was Tokyo Movie Shinsha. It was one of the two. It's been referred to as years as the JAL dub because it was first shown on overseas flights to Japan on that airline.
Have you seen it?
Yes, I've seen it. There are copies out there, none of them particularly good quality, but I mean the dub is a strange animal. Lupin keeps his name, but what's it called? Zenigata, Inspector Zenigata, is referred to as Detective Ed Scott.
Did you say Detective Ed Scott?
Yes.
Wow.
Jigen is called Dan Dunn, and Goemon is just referred to as Samurai.
Well,
in spite of that, I found the dub like really droll and very entertaining. The characterizations of the voices are quite nice, and some of the lines are just way out there. I mean, I think one of my favorite scenes in the movie is a scene where Goemon and Jigen are being interrogated by what is basically a really great caricature of Henry Kissinger. And at one point, like, you know, the FBI heavy who is helping Mr. Kissinger out, just they've decided that, you know, the guys decide that, you know, these people don't really know anything, they're going to try a different approach, so they release them. And as they're leaving the interrogation room, the last thing the FBI agent does is he just turns around and shakes his fist and says, "Be grateful to democracy."
Wow.
So is it kind of Englishy?
It's a little bit. It's a little stilted, but I don't know. I think part of it must be nostalgia, but it's something I've always been really amused by. I wish there was a better quality version out there. I've seen a couple of different versions, but they both feature pretty bad video and pretty bad audio. I think there are efforts underway to restore them by splicing the old audio together with DVD video, but I haven't seen anything like a finished copy yet.
You know, one of the old Japan Airlines dubs that I'm still trying to track down is the bizarre Carl Maychek dub of Castle in the Sky. Have you seen this?
Oh yeah. Well, wait a minute. That I'm pretty sure that dub is included on the Region 2 DVD of Laputa.
Oh, hey, you're right. Oh, yeah, that's the one with the Brick Muppet line, right?
Well, the Brick Muffin, not Brick Muppet.
Oh, it was Muffin?
I was about to say, in what context does Laputa mention Brick Muppet?
Well, either one would make just as much sense. Like, literally, you remember that scene where Shito falls down through the hole in the roof and lands on Pazu?
Mm-hmm.
She goes, "Oh, are you all right?" And he replies, "Don't worry, I'm built like a brick Muppet if Muppets were made out of brick. But I guess it's Muffin now, so you've ruined that for me, thanks."
Said, "My head is built like a brick Muffin if Muffins were made of bricks." I mean, it's just such a strange thing.
That makes no sense in either interpretation.
Must have been during Carl Maychek's cocaine days or something like that. Strung out, sitting in the studio.
Just to get back to some of the strange things that you can find out there, one of my most recent acquisitions is a couple of volumes of, you know, parts 1 and 3 of a three-part series of direct-to-video, like 20-minute-long featurettes of there was a show in the late 80s called Captain Power and the Soldiers of the Future.
I remember that.
Yeah, it was live. You know, the TV series was live action, and it was actually produced by J. Michael Straczynski, so it has a whole bunch of really neat, weird precursors to stuff that you later saw on Babylon 5.
Just real quick, was that the show with the laser tag toys?
Well, the toys were planes with light guns on the front of them, essentially.
Okay, and it interacted with the TV in some way, right?
Yeah, there was strobing light effects on the TV that you could use to, you know, if you hit the trigger when they came on quickly enough, you'd score a point. If you didn't, you would get shot.
I remember that. Anyway, sorry, go on.
The thing about these direct-to-video things is that, you know, they're bookended by little live-action segments where, you know, Captain Power says, you know, "Welcome, recruit. Let's jump into the plane and fight the bad guys." Once you get into the plane, everything suddenly turns into animation. And it's very good, very high quality, very, very high frame rate animation with wonderful detailed vehicles and cityscape. And then it's all over in the credits roll, and you see that the entire thing was directed by Shinji Aramaki.
Yeah,
like the Appleseed. Shinji Aramaki.
Yeah, of Appleseed, of Megazone 2, 3. So there's, you know, there's a reason why everything looks that good. And it's really cool stuff. I mean, the second volume is my favorite because that one involves a raid on Chicago where the Sears Tower gets blown up.
Excellent.
God.
Yeah, I showed that at a panel at Anime Central several years ago, and that went over really well.
I'll bet. So, what else? What other treasures have you discovered there? I know we had a video of the BBC dub of Urusei Yatsura.
Yeah, that's a good one, just because there are a lot of BBC regulars that appear as cast members in that, and notably Matt Lucas of Little Britain fame as Ataru himself.
Didn't you find a dub that was only released in the UK that ADV produced?
Yeah, actually, they produced an English dub of Street Fighter 2V, which was released in the U.S. by Manga Entertainment and dubbed in Los Angeles. But yeah, ADV's dub of Street Fighter 2V was actually produced in Houston. Brett Weaver plays Ken. I don't remember who plays Ryu. But yeah, they produced... I don't think they finished... I'm not sure if they finished the whole series, but several episodes were produced, and it's just kind of amusing. I love it when you have this situation where something is dubbed in its entirety with very similar approaches, you know, just for no real reason.
Maybe because it's Street Fighter 2V and no one really wants to put any effort into that at all.
Could be. I mean, well, another case would be one of your favorites, which would be the Go Shogun, the Time Etranger movie. The UK dub of that is actually going to be winging its way to you very soon and features a Remy that actually has a crazy, fakey French accent.
Well, I'm looking forward to that one.
when something gets multiple dubs, I mean, this was during the days when people had money to spend. I mean, in some cases, I think it was just ego, like they wanted their version of it.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And also, I think it's also some of the stuff that's been produced has been shaking off stigma. Like almost all of Carl Masek's old Streamline Pictures dubs have been replaced by newer, more accurate, not necessarily as entertaining, but, you know, less inaccurate dubs, like the Dirty Pair movies, Akira, a lot of the stuff.
Right. Well, one thing I noticed, because I was, you know, meticulously assembling my new Blu-ray editions of old manga UK dubs, a lot of them that were dubbed overseas, actually the video's sped up because, you know, the frame rate's different over there. Like, Pant Labor's dubbed at 25 frames a second, so if they used that on a new shiny DVD or Blu-ray release here, either they'd have to blur all the frames together to change the frame rate, or they would have to slow it down and it would sound like crap anyway.
Yeah. Would it really sound like crap? I mean, I was always under the impression that it would have to be slowed down, but if you approached it correctly, it wouldn't sound that bad.
Well, if you got the new Blu-ray of Ghost in the Shell 2, or the new DVD of Innocence that Bandai released, they actually included the Manga UK dub of that, and that was dubbed at 25 frames a second, and it's the same vocal cast, but everyone sounds a little lower and talks a little unnaturally slowly.
God, that would make that movie unbearable. Holy shit. Jesus.
I really like that UK dub. I had to remake that Blu-ray for my own.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the movie, too. I mean, it's Bateau and Togus reading Bartlett's Book of Quotations at each other for 90 minutes and driving around in his sweet antique car.
Imagine that movie just even slower. It blows my mind.
You know, I don't like weed, but I imagine that's a great movie to get stoned to.
To get back to UK-only dubs,
right.
There was, what's it called? The staff of the old Anime UK magazine, you know, including the likes of Helen McCarthy and Jonathan Clements, actually underwrote a dubbed version of K.O. Beast Century.
K.O. Beast Century. Now, I don't think most of our listeners even remember K.O. Beast Century.
I do.
Which is interesting, because that came out on DVD in the States.
Yeah, I remember that. I mean, that was one of those, like, tapes, like, when you're trading fansub tapes, like, everyone had a copy of that, but no one really liked it.
Yeah, no one really even bothered tracking out a good copy because everyone's was all like oversaturated and washed out looking.
Anyway, that's interesting because unlike a lot of manga UK dubs, they make no effort to disguise the fact that the cast is British, and it's stilted for a couple of reasons, and that's one of them. Like the delivery is like really kind of hilarious and unnatural. Another good one is there was a dub produced in the UK of all-purpose cultural Catgirl Nuku Nuku, and to try and make that one stand out, they actually had regional accents spoken by the characters. So And the funny thing is, I mean, this is something that you know, most Americans have no concept of, like the idea of British or English regionalism. So some characters sound like they're from London, some characters sound like they're from Southampton, some characters sound like they're from Newcastle. And yeah, but the thing is, it sounds like all the actors are actually London actors, so it's all the accents are fake.
That's weird. That sounds like a very weird viewing experience, especially if you actually know like those accents and you're familiar with them, because you're a big, I imagine you know all things Europe-y because you're a big soccer guy. So
Well, watching a lot of English soccer has kind of helped me contextualize that a little, but it's still a strange experience.
All right, Mike, anything else you wanted to plug or anything you got coming up that you wanted to chat about?
Nothing really on the immediate horizon. I actually have a bunch of nifty little video equipment that I've been trying to put together. Biggest hurdle, actually, to me producing new segments is I don't have anywhere to shoot the office that I have. I actually moved since the last episodes of stuff I made, and the office that I'm in is just impossibly cluttered.
But you're talking about the videos you made for us?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Cool. Well, we still have that one Dubs of Time Forgot that we shot at Otakon that, you know...
That is coming soon. I've got video footage that, like I said, that's going to be winging its way to you very soon. I would have sent it sooner, but I wanted to send you all that UK stuff you've been asking about.
That was actually one of our first that answers our first Twitter question. So we can, if you guys want to, we can get into these. We got a bunch of them.
All right.
Okay. So Twitter cues some tweets. Okay, from Hamsworth. Are there any series that appeal to your inner 10-year-old that you can be unapologetically enthusiastic about? I'll let you guys take that one.
Of course there are. I'd say the most recent one would be, Tengen Toppa Gurren Lagann. I actually watched that in its entirety on Sci-Fi Channel and like basically did it deliberately just to keep myself from going after the fan subs. And it was a great experience to have something that was like, you know, must-see appointment television every Monday night. And yeah, it just blew me away and reminded me why I like the medium so much, with its enthusiasm, with its character.
Yeah,
just a fun show.
I'm not so much a hyperactive 10-year-old about this stuff as I am a overly moody and completely obsessive teenager about this stuff. So the last show I got really worked up about was Big Wind Up, even though the second half just kind of falls to poop. But they spend 11 episodes on one game of baseball. I'm still pissed off about that.
It's only a 26-episode series.
Right. That's over an episode an inning. It's not even an overtime game, but... At any rate, something about sports anime, really well-written, realistic sports anime, and me, it's crack. And I go through this really, really insane phase where I just marathon the whole thing, and then I fall into this deep depression afterwards after it's over.
You've got Everybody Hurts playing, eating a bowl of ice cream, sitting in the corner, surrounded by Hajime no Ippo DVDs.
That totally happened. That happened with Touch, that happened with Ippo, and now it's happening with Big Windup. I actually tracked down all the scanlations just so I could figure out what the hell happened next.
Oh, man. The one for me is One Piece. I am unapologetically love that show. I watch the DVDs as they come out. To me, that is everything I love about shonen anime in one show. Great characters, not as didactic as it could be, but it's still pretty didactic. It's got great story arcs, great villains, great fights. I mean, it's just is what it is, and it's extremely happy being what it is, and it's such a positive, fun show. I love One Piece. I'm still very enthusiastic about that show.
Yeah, I've actually just started watching the online streaming that Funimation is offering of it, and I'm trying to figure out, so I wonder how long it's going to take me to watch like 400 episodes of this.
I want to know how long it's going to take them to dub 400 episodes.
If they get that far, yeah.
Well, they're like 75 episodes in already, right?
Yeah, the most recent ones I think I saw were up through like 78 on DVD.
They have like the whole studio going 24 hours just on One Piece.
You know, if they still keep money coming into the franchise somehow, they'll keep making it. So yeah.
From Speed Tracer, clever. What do you think about the drama CDs and image songs that accompany most anime today? And do you have any favorites? I'm not going to answer this because I don't listen to any of that shit.
Today? But, they've been doing that since the 80s.
Yeah, they've been doing it since the 80s.
I have a few examples. A couple of them have been dubbed into English and thrown onto DVDs as extras. I actually like this approach and wish it was done more often, because it's an ancillary product that, you know, non-Japanese fans just don't really get much exposure to. To answer the question of which one would my favorite be is, there was a Big O drama CD called Walking Along the Yellow Brick Road that was released shortly after the original series ended its run in 1999. It was just a little side project that was actually spearheaded by the show's chief screenwriter, Chiaki Konaka, and it basically comes off as like, you know, cold reading of just like this droll little story by all the main characters where they all just kind of meet up together one day and talk about what's going on in their lives.
Now, how do you listen to this? Do you just listen along with a script?
If you look carefully, there is a script that was created for it that is pretty accurate and pretty readable.
There have been a couple over the years that have been fan subbed. There was one guy that did a pretty good job of it with like graphics and everything that did a Evangelion. It was called After the End.
I remember that.
And so that's one way to do it. Actually, come to think of it, there have been a few image songs that I have in my iTunes that are kind of guilty pleasures.
I love image songs.
They're so dumb. And I have to, like, there's this one by Urameshi Yusuke from Yu Yu Hakusho. And he's literally talking about singing about how much he loves fighting. And it's so stupid. But it's a good song. I can't stop listening to it.
Well, see, I tend to enjoy image songs because more than anything else, they really expose what terrible singers most say you are.
Oh, yeah.
Do you guys remember that Fushigi Yugi album?
Oh, that was unlistenable.
Oh, my God. I had that. I'm not sure I have it anymore, but I totally had that.
Yeah, me too. I bought it from the anime store back when I was into Fushigi Yugi. And, like, every character has a song. And they're, like, singing about their special powers. And how it relates to their personality.
That just sounds like death.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great, ain't it?
Okay. All right, moving on. We got two from Bradley C. Meek. Say I found a particular sequence of animation really impressive. How would I go about finding out who did the key animation for it? It's a good question. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Credits?
I'd say start by looking at the single episode credits.
Which aren't translated half the time.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem. The only person I know who really pays attention to that is there's one blogger online who really breaks down the science of animation. And
Ben Ettinger at Anapages?
Anapages, yeah, that fella.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite animation blogs, although he kind of goes off on other tangents as well.
But... Yeah, he goes off on tangents, but he keeps me discovering new talent when ordinarily I wouldn't see it.
He, by himself, has taught me more about the actual intricacies of animation in Japan than probably anyone else. It's an amazing blog. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I was going to say, so start with that blog if you want to, because that guy watches a lot of stuff, and he will break down very carefully who animated what.
Second one from Bradley. What do you look for in a review as editors and then as readers? Yeah, what I look for in a review is competence, a strong voice, and analytical skill. If someone turns in a review that just says, this show is good, and not literally this show is good, but it's a whole lot of words to just say this show is good. They're not really saying anything else about it. Like, I'll get review submissions where it's 800 words and it says nothing. It just says, this show isn't like anything else you've ever seen, and they never tell you why. Like, I want analysis, I want intelligence, I want depth, and entertaining is good too. Like, if you can write an entertaining, fun-to-read review, that's even better. But for our standard full-length reviews, the analytical side of it is the number one thing. As a reader, I want the same things. I mean, that's what I look for in a good review. So that's really it.
Well, I think of having a good, strong voice is probably the most important thing to me. I don't know. It's hard for me to explain simply because I don't read a lot of anime reviews. I have to confess, most of the criticism I read that is contemporary is either by Roger Ebert or by Tasha Robinson, the film critic for The Onion.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And largely because they're critics that I've kind of been following for years. And the thing you'll see in their works, which is something that I like, is they are able to write good, engaging, interesting reviews of really terrible, awful shit. And they're able to tell me that, okay, if I think this is bad, but they can still communicate in their review that I might like it.
Right. One thing that Roger Ebert does that I'm a huge fan of is when something is terrible, he will kind of go off on a story about how terrible it is and not really talk a whole lot about the movie. Mm-hmm. But if something is amazing, he doesn't go on and on about how great it is. That's when he really gets into the analysis.
Yeah.
His books of his negative reviews are the greatest things. They're yeah. great. I love those. Yeah, you could just I'll waste a whole afternoon just digging through those things.
Your movie sucks.
Yep. from Cal Aggie, are DVD extras being missed in this age of half-season box sets and digital streaming, or have many viewers moved on? I think people have moved on. I don't give a shit about special features on anime DVDs.
Well, most special features were things no one really cared that much about in the first place. I mean, I'm sorry, voice actor commentary? Those people have nothing to say. They're in a booth. They usually haven't really even done any deep character analysis. They're usually just like, make this voice, okay? And that's it.
It's also a lot of them trying to be entertaining, which frequently is not entertaining at all.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, if you ever gone to a convention and just wandered into one of the voice actor panels and just stood in the back of the room and watched these self-important actors...
Not
just,
all of them.
Not all of them, but half the time it's just one big wank fest up there.
Mm. And well, that's what they show up for. I mean,
some people eat that stuff up. Me, it makes me want to, go outside. Chainsmoke.
I used to go to those panels a lot, but after a certain point, I felt like I'd heard all of the story. I think it's more valuable if you're going to go to an event like an anime con to see the actor, to try to approach them and meet them.
Well, to some extent, we're probably spoiled. I mean, we know several voice actors, most of the cool ones, and the good stories are not going to be told on stage.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. But going back to the question, honestly, I think what people wanted was a lot of episodes for little money, and that's what they're getting now, so that trumps everything else. So long as you're giving me 13 to 26 episodes for $40, I'm happy. I don't need the lenticular file we talked about tchotchkes a couple of weeks ago, all the ridiculous shit they used to put in there.
The pencil boards, the...
Oh, horrible. Horrible.
Yeah.
I still have a little tiny stuffed wolf from the Wolf's Rain box.
I remember that. That was a crappy little toy.
I was grateful for one of the big box sets with, you know, one disc in it that Funimation put out of Kodocha had a little plush Babbitt Christmas ornament, and I still think that's really awesome. And
okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
Now I gotta ask you though,
you can do something with that.
Exactly.
I gotta ask you though that I just recalled this about that Wolf's Rain plush. The way it was manufactured, it only will stand on three legs, and its left hind leg is permanently raised. Does yours do that? Because that's what mine did.
Hang on a sec. Let me take off the phones. I'm going to check this. Give me a second. Okay, I got it. And it's actually, I never really took it out of the wrapper. But
clearly it's something you cherish.
Yes. All right, well, let's have a look at Kiba. I have to post a photo of this thing. It has a little button. Its front legs are dramatically shorter than its hind legs. So it's not even one back leg. Sticking up, both of them are.
Okay.
Mine is just kind of face planting into the ground. I'll send you a photo of this.
Okay, I'll put it in the show notes.
I wonder if I still have one of those awful Shadow Star Narutaru plush things. Got rid of my doggy poo.
That show was one of the most poorly animated things I've ever seen.
You know, I tried to watch it so many times because it's like, you know, kids being horrible to each other and traumatizing each other.
Yeah, the story is not so bad, but I could not watch it just because it was so ugly and like low frame rate and just lazy and crummy. And
I liked I read most of the comics. They were pretty good.
You know, that manga artist also did, what was that one that came out, Bokurano, that came out a couple years ago, and that was also about kids being really shitty to each other. One has to wonder what that guy's childhood was like.
Okay, from Stringed Sonata, what are your thoughts on classic anime that are adapted from classic literature, and what classic novel would you like to see made into anime?
That's a really good question. Wow.
Yeah.
Good questions this week.
We have good listeners. Three.
Anybody have an answer?
No.
Yeah, absolutely. One I've always just kind of dreamed about just idly is a TV series adaptation by Studio Ghibli, or, you know, by Takahata and Miyazaki, of 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
I wish I were educated enough to agree with you on that.
I'm really regretting going to film school right about now.
I'm sure that would be awesome. However, I've never read that book, so I can't really comment, but that's a good answer.
It's a good story and a resonant story. It's the thing about it is it's full of really powerful, weird images that I would love to see animated. One of my favorite bits in the book is when, you know, a group of lost villagers are tromping through the woods, you know, 100 miles inland, and they come across a Spanish galleon in the middle of a field just sitting there. And so they clamber aboard, and the only thing they find in the entire ship is one skeleton wearing very badly rusted conquistador armor. And that's it. Just like all kinds of weird little fascinating things like that.
I'm going to say I want a 13-episode drenched in yaoi subtext version of a separate piece.
That is the only way that book would be palatable.
In all seriousness, though, like, I liked Genkutsuo. I was cool with that. I updating that stuff is fine. I'd like to see him do more, you know, classic literature, like any of Poe's stuff. Some Jules Verne would be nice, you know.
I'm thinking specifically juvenile literature, and like juvenile American literature would be awesome, like some kind of you know, World Masterpiece Theater adaptation of Johnny Tremaine or My Brother Sam is Dead or something like that.
Yeah, I think what kills a lot of those World Masterpiece Theater shows is the fact that they're 39 episodes, so that's not a lot of material for 39 episodes.
Yeah.
So they end up being really slow and drawn out.
So, Justin, you don't have really anything. Okay, well, that's pretty much the end of the Twitter questions. I guess that's it. Mike, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
And we will see you all next week. Thanks for listening.